Good morning. I want to start, I assume I have now got the hardcore wealthy of the objectivist audience. The rest having given up after a week. I want to start by giving you a written assignment, which is optional, because I'll probably only be able to take up a few in class. This is for Thursday's class on writing versus thinking. Now, I asked in advance for writing problems, and the questions that I got, with one or two exceptions, had nothing to do with writing problems. They were just problems in philosophy. So what I'd like you to do is to write a 150-word piece. That's approximately half a page if you had a typewriter. Or if you don't, please print it. Don't handwrite it. 150 words you can easily do by Thursday, printing, because I can't read the handwriting. And make two copies, one for yourself and one for me. This should be a letter to the editor of a newspaper, one that you read and that you have some sense of, on any relevant topic that pertains to, in some way, philosophy, politics, ethics, religion. And all I want you to do in this letter is write it in such a way that its relevance is clear to the editor, why his paper should be interested in this, what it's got to do with him, unless it's self-evident, such as an attack on Bush. No, because that's self-evidently connected to the election. And then try to make one or two crucial points. But they must be self-contained and self-intelligible. There's no use telling him Bush is no good because he violates the principle of the hierarchy of cognition. And this is very hard to do. The shorter a letter, the harder it is to write, because you have to condense more and more and still make it intelligible, bring your context along, or write in such a brilliant way that you can count only on their context and nevertheless make your startling point. I'd like the tone of the letter to be strong, but not venomous. Try to avoid being either wimpy and apologetic or coming on, you know, like you have the word of God and everyone else is swine. It's a very difficult task that I'm giving you, precisely because it's so short. You have to take some crucial point or points and delimit them so you can only say X about them, that's all. And yet they still have to be clear, and it has to be apparent why you're making that point rather than some other point. And it's got to have some sort of structure and come to a conclusion. On the bottom of the page, since you'll only be writing on half a page, if you feel you have failed in various ways, name what the problem is. I couldn't make it simple enough. I didn't know how to express this point. I don't know what context is required for this. I couldn't think of how to start. Whatever is the problem that stops you. And then I'm going to just pick people at random and ask them to bring me up their copy, and I will read it aloud for the first time as you hear it. This is after I give a brief introductory lecture on the issues of writing and thinking. And then we will together try and see whether we can solve any writing problems that, in a way that will be of broader interest to everybody who does any writing. Now, of course, if everybody hands in completely perfect letters, you won't learn anything from this exercise except how good you are, and then you should go out and try and publish them. But I assume that there will be some problems that some people have just inducing from past experience. All right, that's the assignment, and as I say, it couldn't possibly take more than four or five people anyway, so if you just can't face it or can't do it, don't. I'm sure there'll be four or five will show up with it. But if you actively want personal attention, this is your one chance in the class to get. Now, we are going to go to the topic of thinking in principle, which I believe you're well motivated to learn. But what we want to know is, what does it mean and how do you do it? Well, we have to start by asking, what is a principle? And I went through some years ago the Oxford English Dictionary on this. You know, they will give 8 or 10, 15, 20 definitions of each word. You have to pick out the ones that you think are essential, and sometimes there's 1, 8, and 12 are the three that will gear you into the word, and the others are little derivative uses that are unimportant or archaic or whatever. But I found three definitions that together made clear to me what a principle is. So you have to sort of take the Oxford English Dictionary, which has the best resource of anything on the English language, and follow along with what you get summarizing as you go. Now here's the first definition that I picked from there. Now, a principle, remember, that's the word we're talking about, P-R-I-N-C-I-P-L-E. The first definition was origin, source of action, beginning, interestingly enough, fountainhead, original or initial state, first place. And obviously it comes from the Latin prin, which is first. Prince is the first son, you know. It was the front of an army, the part which started the fighting, was called the principle. And here is a citation from 1432. The beginnings of that water called Tiber, and of the water off Jordan, which have their principle at the foot of Mount Libanus. Now their principle means the source, where they come from. And here's another citation from 1674. Improving their ports and magazines has given principle to no inconsiderable navy. Has given principle means has been the origin. That's what started it. That was the first thing that led to these various consequences. So from this I get basically the idea, principle means the beginning from which later things follow. The first thing in a series which leads to later things. Now that's not yet principle as we use it, but that's an indispensable element to principle, and as you see that goes all the way back to the 15th century and I'm sure earlier. Now the definition that I got for second, and you see the trouble with the dictionary doesn't perform philosophic analysis. It doesn't tell you what the relation between the second and the first is. It just gives them to you, and you got to figure out how they relate to each other. Now the second definition that I picked, I will read it to you exactly as they give it. A fundamental truth, law, or motive force. And then they give this description. Fundamental truth or proposition on which many others depend. A primary truth comprehending or forming the basis of various subordinate truths. A general statement or tenet forming the ground of or held to be essential to a system of thought or belief. A fundamental assumption forming the basis of a chain of reasoning. Now, who can see a similarity between all of those and the original one, which was the beginning from which the later follows, including the beginning of a mountain or the beginning of an army. Now, this is the same essential idea, only what did we do to it? We transferred it from the physical to the intellectual, to the epistemological. A principle is still the beginning from which the later follows, but it's now the intellectual beginning from which a number of intellectual consequences follow. So instead of being just the source or origin of something, it becomes a truth on which all kinds of things depend, a fundamental truth, a basic truth, a primary truth. And the definition stresses over and over that a lot of other things depend on it. Many others depend. Various subordinate truths, a whole system of thought or belief, a chain of reasoning. So the idea is this very fertile, fundamental generalization or idea from which there's a lot of intellectual consequences. Now there's a third one that you have to decide, what are you going to do with this? And the rest are all just little picky lexicographical type things. But here's the third one that's a possible candidate to be incorporated. A general law or rule adopted or professed as a guide to action. a settled ground or basis of conduct or practice, a fundamental motive or reason of action. Now, this makes principle, in effect, essentially an ethical issue, a principle guiding you, telling you how to behave. Now, here your own philosophy is going to be relevant. Whether you think that fundamental truths play a role in cognition, an essential role, and play the same essential role in ethics, or whether you think man acts from sources that have nothing to do with his thought, and that therefore this is a completely independent issue, the rule or guide to action. Now, we hold as objectivists that ethics is simply an application to life of certain other fundamental truths. And that therefore, I would say this definition as a guide to action is merely an application to the realm of action of the same concept of principle as applies in any field. You have principles that guide action, principles that guide cooking, principles that guide thinking, and there's no reason in the world to reserve the word principle for that which guides action, although it happens to be very important. You say he's an unprincipled man, you're focusing on his lack of principle in action. Nevertheless, intellectually, this does not add anything, and I mention it simply so you do not narrow principle down to guide to action. Our best definition, putting it all together, is the idea of a basic or first cause, and then transferring it to the intellectual, the conceptual first cause, which has many derivatives. And that's how I think of principle, the conceptual first cause. Now, there's a lot of different ways you can word that, but it's like the source of the river, only it's in the intellectual domain. Or you can think of it as a fundamental generalization. It's always general because it can't be fundamental if it's just a concrete or a particular. It has to be something very broad and that will enable us to get out of it a whole bunch of consequences. Now, the first thing to see, I hope those definitions don't lose your interest, but it's a good method to follow. If you're finding a word and you don't know where to start, go to an exhaustive dictionary, which is only one in English, the OED, and pick out everything that seems to have a clue in the direction, and then put them together yourself, deciding which is really crucial, and then work out your own definition based on that. They have done wonderful work in collecting every significant use of a word from, like, the Middle Ages to the present, and they've organized it as well as they can without benefit of philosophy. So it's a joy to try to figure out a definition. They don't give you exactly what you want, but they give you everything you could need to get what you want. Whereas if you go to any other dictionary, it's like they simply give you the conclusion without the citations and without the development to explain why this is the definition. So I definitely would recommend, if you're interested in definitions, the Oxford Dictionary. If you can do it in the two-volume thing with a magnifying glass and enough Dramamine to conquer the seasickness, that's okay. But I sprung for the whole big one because I think it's very valuable. Now, let's make as our first point that a principle, therefore, is not synonymous with any generalization. You can think of it as an integration of generalizations. It's much more abstract than the normal generalization. And if you formulate it properly, we'll illustrate all this very quickly, it represents the cause or explanation of all this derivative generalizations. It's the basis on which you can understand all the things that come from it. So we can look at it this way. A principle is to an ordinary generalization as a concept is to its concretes. A principle is to an ordinary generalization as a concept is to its concretes. It is the integrator that unites all those lesser generalizations into one unit, just the way the concept table does unite into one unit all the percepts of tables. Now, someone is going to want to ask, judging from past experience, how many derivative generalizations must a statement have to qualify as a principal? And of course, I can't give you a numerical answer. I can't say 12 or 38 or whichever. It is contextual, as it is in the theory of definition. When we say the essence is that which underlies a great many of the distinctive characteristics, I can't tell you how many. It has to be just enough to qualify as significant within a given context. And the fact that principle in one context can be seen to be merely a derivative of a deeper, wider principle in a deeper context. So, in other words, we'll come again across the point that we mentioned under essences, that we have to define via fundamentals, but what's fundamental in one context is not necessarily so in another. A principle is the deepest level of integration possible within a given context. Now, let me give you an example of this point. Suppose I observe that censorship takes all intelligence out of the books that are published. And public ownership of the steel industry makes the steel worthless. And 15 other instances where coercion acts to stifle creativity. And I then say, the principle here is force leads to destruction, or force is the antithesis of values. You see, or force is the opposite of what the mind requires. Now, that would be a principle. There are hundreds of applications and derivatives of it, and it unites all those. And if you can think in that principle, you see the reason for capitalism. And if all you can do is hold all those concretes, you'll think all I need to do is change the sensors, or, you know, have new people running the factories. I could still get away with it. But if you get to the point of force leads to destruction, you have come across a basic principle within the context of what subject? Politics. Now, can you jump to a much wider context of which force leads to destruction is merely a concrete? It is no longer functioning as a principle. Yes.
Force is anti-mind.
Well, even that is just a concrete. Force is anti-mind is just a concrete of what principle in metaphysics? Well, that's a little too broad identity. I'm talking about a relation between doing something and getting a result, enacting a cause, namely force, and getting an effect, right? So if I was teaching metaphysics, the principle here would be cause and effect. And then the example, the derivative, would be force leads to destruction. Now that will show you that these things are all contextual. And therefore I'm telling you that you do not always go to the very widest principle right away. If you do, you're going to end up with only philosophic principles, just in the same way that I could go all the way back to causality, I go all the way back to identity, I go all the way back to something in philosophy and leave the particular field that I'm in, which is not always desirable to do. Philosophic principles, to be sure, are crucial, but it is not enough to have in your mind only direct observations and then philosophic principles. You have to have these, what we can call intermediate level principles, as your guide. In exactly the same way as it's not enough to have broad abstractions or broad concepts like being and attribute and so on, and then just what you directly perceive. There's a whole vast range of middle-level abstractions that are absolutely essential to thought. Therefore, for the purposes of this lecture, we are not interested in principles insofar as they take us all the way back to philosophy. Or if we are, it's only a peripheral to our main concern. We're interested in integration of generalizations within a given context of knowledge and relating to a specific field like politics, agriculture, whatever it happens to be. As against right away jumping to the whole universe, because we'll lose exactly the kind of knowledge we need to function in a specific field if you abstract away from everything. Now, I have found that the best way to make clear what a principle is, not everything about principles, but at least what it is, because the trickiest thing is to get a class to grasp what is a principle and what isn't. I will give you an example of things that some student or other in the course of history has suggested to me as being a principle, when in fact it is not a principle, not even in the restricted context he's talking about. And you volunteer for me what would be a principle of which that would be just an instance, or that would be just a derivative. Now, you don't have to even be right. I'm not concerned here with what is the true principle. I just want you to get an idea of the level of approach that something requires to become a principle as against just an interesting generalization. Now, one class, forget about Manx cats or whatever, the ones that don't have tails, because that's not the point. One class suggested to me that all cats have tails as a principle. Now, I'm here to say it is not. That is what you could call a low-level direct generalization from observation. That is certainly not a principle. All you could get out of all cats have tails is Socrates is a cat, therefore Socrates has a tail. But that's, I mean, now, it's much too concrete. And it's not an integration, except of cats, to tails. It doesn't connect to any other things within the area of animal life or biology, and therefore that is definitely not a principle. But now, what might be a principle, now I'm not going to argue biology here, that would correspond to this level of discourse and from which this would follow or be understandable? Are you going to give me something plausible?
Does it have tails? Use them for balance.
Well, you're giving the function of the tail, so you're giving a little broader, but that is still much too narrow for what we want. I want now to give you an idea of a level of principle that would explain this and hundreds of other things about hundreds of other animals. So if you keep it just to tails, unless there is such a subject as tailology, you know, where there's a whole series of principles all the way back that explain millions of things about tails, but I'm assuming something broader than that, yes.
Genetics lead to physical...
Okay, something on the order of the theory of evolution would be a principle. Something on the order of animals develop their structure according to genetic features or according to evolutionary requirements of survival. Now that's a massive generalization. But on the basis of that, you are able to explain, predict, understand hundreds and thousands of observations from tails on up and down. Now obviously we're leaving open the question, how do you get to such a generalization as the theory of evolution? You don't get to it by saying all cats have tails, all dogs wag them while they're happy, therefore it must be the theory of evolution. And in fact, philosophy can't even tell you how to get to the principle of evolution because that's science. All I want you to do right now is to get the difference in level between the two ideas, animals evolve thus and how, versus all cats have tails. The second would qualify as a principle. Now, I'm not saying there might not be intermediate principles less exalted than that, but I want to strike you at the beginning with the importance of having a broad enough concept of principle, of the term principle. Principle is an honorific term. In other words, when you apply that to something, you are making a fuss about it. You're saying, this is something big and basic in my context. Now, I'm going to give you another one from a completely different field that a student suggested, and you tell me what would be a principle. Now, this is not as exalted an area, but nevertheless, the distinction applies. Student one suggested to me in New York that the principle would be this. If you travel by subway, allow extra time because the trains are sometimes late. Now, that's a generalization. All subway travelers should do so and so. But that is incredibly too concrete. As soon as you see the word trains and subway and so on, you know, whatever level you're on, this is not a concrete, because you could just as well say, if you're going by the IRT, that's one of the subway lines in New York. If you're going by the IRT at rush hour to your dentist to have cavities filled, then leave 18 to 20 minutes, because there are often crashes, you know, at Grand Central. I mean, would that be a principle? I mean, you're verged there on saying, I'll take you by the hand and walk you to the train. This is almost entirely concrete. Now, take this idea. If you travel by subway, allow extra time because the trains are sometimes late, and try to generalize it as broadly as you can. Now, if you're going to go all the way and just say, well, what it really says is recognize the facts of reality, then you have retreated to philosophy. You're just giving, be rational then, and that's okay. But we knew that already. But we want to know, can we get a principle, in this case a guide to action, that is much broader than the one about travel by subway, but is not so broad as, you know, stay in touch with reality. The back.
One should plan ahead.
Okay, that's a good idea. One should plan ahead. That, if you might want to just make it a little more explicit, plan ahead to allow for unforeseen contingencies. See, now that is broad enough to encompass the subway train, plus if it's rush hour, you need to get a cab, you better go out there early, and also if it's bad weather, and plus, not just your time, carry extra money if you go out shopping because you don't know what you might meet, and suppose you're a teacher, have some extra material ready in case the class is unexpectedly silent and you run out, etc., etc. There's 1,001 applications of this plan ahead for unforeseen contingencies, and you could integrate all of them and therefore use it to predict and guide your own future if you have it on that level. But if you have it as, this is the rule for the subways, this is the IRT, this is the BMT, this is the IND, this is, you know, it's the crow epistemology. You just cannot hold it, and so you just end up doing whatever you feel like. Now, I'll give you another example here, but this, I think, is perhaps laboring the point too much, so we'll do it quickly. Somebody suggested as a principle, if you want to grow bananas in Arizona, you need irrigation ditches. Now, what would the real principle, you don't have to give me the content of it, be, but in category of formulation, yes. Excellent. Except you're getting there, you're verging on pure philosophy there. Nature to be commanded must be obeyed. So let's try to get something a little lower on the scale, and I would say something like this. Agriculture involves definite conditions of temperature, water, soil, etc. In other words, the principle of scientific farming as opposed to, in Arizona with this crop, if you don't put ditches in, they rot, you see, which is just your preliminary observation. And at a certain point, you come to grasp that there's such a thing as scientific farming, that all crops depend on certain conditions because they're living organisms, and then you can state a broad principle that will govern, you know, your activities in all of these type of fields. And you will see then, when you reach this broad principle, it will explain why does there have to be irrigation here and heat added in this country and so on and so on, because they're living organisms, in this case plants. They require certain conditions to flourish, and that explains all the empirical observations. Now, you should get used to, I say this more or less in conclusion of this first point, trying to formulate a principle whenever you think one is around, just as practice in thinking on the right level, not too broad and not too narrow. And the key to it is, whenever you say such and such is right in principle, or such and such is wrong in principle, that is an IOU, the words in principle. And what you owe to be able to say that is the ability to state the principle. If you say this is wrong in principle, the logical retort of anybody, including your own mind, should be, which principle? What is the principle that this is violating? Now, for instance, You're sitting in a doctor's office. No, excuse me, you're sitting in a potential employer's office. And you decide to add some material, false material, to your resume in order to get the job. And somebody sitting next to you says, that's wrong in principle to doctor your resume. Even if you get away with it, it's wrong in principle. Now, just on that simple example, it makes a big difference what you formulate as the principle. Because if you formulate the principle wrongly, inadequately, too narrowly, too widely, and without the right conditions, you'll never be able to use it, apply it, integrate it, or prove it. Now, rather than kill time showing you this by the Socratic method, I'll just give you some wrong answers. Wrong in principle to doctor your resume, to distort it. Well, is the principle you should not cheat your employer? It's wrong, after all, he's giving you in good faith, so you shouldn't cheat your employer. Would that be the principle?
Nope.
Obviously not. Why not? It's much too narrow, and whatever reasons there are not to cheat your employer would apply to your wife and your child and your doctor, etc., and so on. Well, then let's jump in the other direction. Lying is wicked. And doctoring your resume is a form of lying. Therefore, that's it. Now, that is certainly would be a principle, because it would cover countless cases in real life. I mean, thousands of different and tricky examples, and it gives you one unequivocal answer: wrong. Now, what's wrong with that as a formulation of the principle? But that's always the best objection, if it's not true. And the reason it's not true, of course, is that there are cases where it's perfectly proper to lie in self-defense and in other cases. So if you try to make it that, you'll end up like Kant. Well, how about if I give you this as the formulation of the principle? It's wrong to mislead someone when it's to your own selfish interest. That's the principle. You see, that white lying is okay, but black lying is bad. So you have to decide, is that a valid point or not? Does selfishness, the thing that makes lying bad, and as long as you do it unselfishly, it's okay? And that will bring you, you know, into the whole question of egoism and altruism and your obligations to others, etc. Now, obviously, objectivists would not accept that formulation of the principle. And who would give me the best formulation given by Galt in his speech? And one of the great things about Galt's speech and all of Miss Rand's writings, which you will come to appreciate more when you are more aware of what's required to formulate a principle, is the level and precision on which she can formulate these things and cover all of these mistakes without saying them, exclude every single one in a brief speech given in an emotional context to the world over the radio. It's a fantastic feat of precision. Yeah.
Never try to gain a value by faking reality.
Exactly right. Never try to gain a value by faking reality. Since you know that, then I don't have to go into it. But if you remember, for instance, my chapter on honesty, my sequence on honesty in the book, that was exactly what I reduced the thing to, taking my lead from Miss Rand, and then it was that I tried to prove and illustrate and validate. Certainly not, I wouldn't talk about employers as an end in itself, perhaps just as a casual example. Nor would I make a flat, sweeping generalization, nor would I contradict the base of ethics when I suddenly get to this one. But this is an excellent formulation, because gaining values leaves open that you can lie to defend them, you see, from those who try to take them away, and specifically through faking reality, you see. So this formulation explains what is correct, what element is correct in those other three attempts, and what elements are wrong. And it doesn't mislead you onto a wild goose chase in your attempt to validate. So it's very important to grasp a principle and grasp it as broadly as necessary within the context and as exactly as possible within the context. Now, I've already really answered this, but I just want to cover it, hit the nail on the head. What do principles add to our cognition? Now remember, for objectivism, principles are an essential of cognition. They're an essential of action only in the sense that action follows from what you think. But they are primarily a cognitive device or mechanism. They're applicable in regard to any subject matter. And the question is, what is it that principles give us? If you were stripping away now just the ethical implications, I want to get more broadly into the epistemology. What does a principle bring with it that a series of ordinary generalizations or a whole broad philosophy by itself does not? Yes, sir, in the back.
Integration with our other knowledge.
Well, what other knowledge?
Well, each knowledge related to a particular situation.
Well, in other words, I think you're saying this then.
It's
certainly the key is integration. What is integrated is all of the countless sub-generalizations that are put together in this principle. All of the direct observations and even the higher level ones about cats or agriculture or subways, whatever it happens to be, or fraud, I mean, this field is wide open. What a principle does is put together all of those sub-generalizations into a unit. So it's the same issue as what a concept does to a person. And it's an essential element of a conceptual consciousness. As we'll see at the end, although there's a way in which you can escape principles, in another sense you cannot, because a conceptual faculty does have to integrate. And it either does it knowingly and correctly or unknowingly and mistakenly, but it can't get around it. And you can't get around some kind of generalizations, and you can't even get around integrating them, because of the crow epistemology, you couldn't function at all. So this is not an option in the basic sense, but of course you have to do it correctly. And I would put it this way. Principles integrate into a unit and thus make retainable countless subsumed generalizations. In fact, if I broke that up into like three functions, I would stress first the word retainable. Principles make their countless instances retainable. In all the examples that we mentioned, I think that's clear. Otherwise, you just couldn't hold 50, 70, 100 different generalizations about wheat and subtype wheat 1 and wheat in the Arctic and wheat in the Antarctic and, you know, etc. Mind would just give up. You could not begin simply because of lack of ability to condense into a unit that you can hold a scientific agriculture if you didn't have principles, and the same is true of principles of public speaking. You can read an entire book and it's all very helpful, but there's those kind of books which are all highly concrete, you know, open with a smile and a joke, but the joke shouldn't be something funny just happened on the way to the class, because audiences are bored with that. And then after you open, tell them what you're going to tell them, but don't tell them in detail because they can't understand it yet. Just give it to them in a plan, but not in a complicated... And by the time you get through 400 pages of that, they say, now go out and give a speech. You've learned a great deal, but it's useless to you. You cannot retain it unless you bring it into your mind under principles. And usually, at least I find in my experience, I can work with about 4-5 principles at a time, and that's it. So as I'm reading one of those books, I'll say, well, this is motivation. This, he wants us to tell a joke and so on, to motivate the audience, to get them interested. And then from there on, I file as the principle, motivation is an essential. And every time somebody says something that I think is helpful to speech making, I have to decide, is this motivational or not? And once you file it that way, thereafter, when you want to motivate, it'll be fed back to you. Whereas if all you ask your subconscious is, give me something decent, it hasn't got anything to give you. So you have to retain by breaking up into defined principles the mass of practical or observed data that you start with. Now, secondly, principles make your observations intelligible, understandable, because you integrate them to one another. And so it's not a bunch of loose concrete, they all cohere into one unit. And of course, thirdly, they enable you, therefore, to predict the future, because they abstract away from time conditions. In the same way that the concept table is applicable to all future tables, anything you learn about tables, any subgeneralization that is finally integrated into a principle will be true of everything within that category. Now, I want to just pause for a moment on this issue that principles make your observations intelligible or understandable by integrating them to one another. Because I've been asked this question by intelligent students, why does integrating generalizations make them intelligible or explain them? Couldn't you say, well, if you don't understand why wheat requires water, or whatever it is, pineapples require heat, etc., on that level, why does putting them all together into one big generalization make it intelligible? Wouldn't you then just have, somebody ask me, a giant incomprehensibility substituting for a whole bunch of lower level incomprehensibilities? Now, this is actually the viewpoint of a school called logical positivism. In fact, just called positivism, because this was the idea originated by Auguste Comte, that the world is unintelligible, that everything you observe you can describe, but you have no clue as to why, and that all science is an economical description of the brute, absurd, unintelligible facts of the world. So there is no such thing as understanding. There's only describing. Now, objectivism, of course, rejects that altogether, because, in our view, understanding is integration. It is not a mystical light that goes off in your head. Principles integrate concretes, concrete generalizations. In other words, bring them into relation to one another, and thereby they become mutually illuminating. Now, you can see this even on the level of simple concept formation. When you see one table just by itself for the first time, you cannot distinguish anything about it. You don't know what it's like or unlike the first time when you're starting at the level of a child. But if you see several tables in relation to chairs or beds, then a pattern becomes clear to you, a certain kind of shape, which you see repeated over and over in variations. You can detect it. And now that little square of your perceptual world is orderly. And then you find out from somebody, they were built so we could hold various objects, and you see why they're built that way. And now you are in business. Next time you see a table, you understand it. Why? Well, what is more do you know than you knew about any one of them? You now can bring it into relation to all of them, and within your context, you have an area that makes sense as against that isolated dot or this crawling spider or whichever, where you just can't do anything with it. Now, the same applies to generalizations. If you see all what's needed for peaches in New Mexico and carrots in Arizona, etc., you're just collecting data. But when you see all those concretes together, when you integrate into the living organism needs such and such conditions, then you understand. So it's the exact same pattern. Understanding is nothing more than integration. Now, it follows from this that the very basic facts of the universe, whatever they are, you cannot say, I want to understand them. They simply are the given. Now, I don't care at this point what the basic facts are. For instance, whether matter is atomic is an irreducible fact, or you know what Ayn Rand and I, in a humorous way, used to call the ultimate ingredients of the world, which were even tinier than subatomic particles. We used to call it little stuff. And little stuff is whatever the stuff is that makes up everything. So even if we did that as a joke, but in order to free our thinking from the specific content of physics, you see. And the idea was, whatever the laws governing little stuff are, obviously we haven't reached these, those laws themselves cannot be explained by the basis of anything prior or more fundamental. So that's the way this stuff operates. In the same, in an analogous way, can you explain to me why is A, A? Well, you can't say because A is B and B is A, therefore A is A. And A is A, that's it. That is just the way reality is. And the same would have to be true of the ultimate laws of physics. All explanation or all understanding consists in starting with observed data and taking it back one step at a time, reducing it back to the ultimate laws, to the metaphysical primaries. And each step back, therefore, is a step in the direction of greater understanding. Why? Because in each step, you are tying what you learned to more and more ranges of data. You are integrating more and more and more as you go from principle to deeper principle, you see. And therefore, each step helps to clarify all of its ingredients the way each table helps to clarify other tables. So it's in that sense that principles take you, are the way of understanding, and understanding consists of ultimately integrating on such a scale that when you say matter or little stuff or whatever it is, and the few whatever laws there are that govern it, everything else in the universe is seen to follow from that. You don't ask for an infinite regress, that's when you say existence exists. Now, if you understand that point, you won't have the problem that all science can do is describe, but it can't explain. It explains everything that there is to explain, but explanation is tying everything together via principles until you finally reach the irreducible facts. You see? And therefore, this is the epistemological role of principle. The cognitive role is our only means, once we have concepts, of using them to understand the data of reality. So principles are not primarily a requirement of action. That happens to be an important role, but all knowledge is crucial because of the action it enables us to take. They are first and foremost principles a requirement of cognition. Now, I don't think I have to keep repeating this over and over again. Yeah, I've got this down about six times, but I think that's too much. Now, what we want to do, I've given you a general introduction to what are principles and why are they necessary, what do they accomplish. We want to learn to think in principle. That is, I'm not going to teach you here the principles of any particular subject, you know. I'm trying to just get you on the idea of how to approach whatever you approach, whatever you read in the newspapers or whatever other people say or whatever comes up in your own mind, how to get it into the form of principles that you can thereby judge and analyze. And one of the best ways to do that is to take something that strikes you as unusual, either unusually good or unusually bad, and try to put in the form of a principle what it is that this thing represents. If it's unusually good, you'll learn something that will greatly expand your ability because you'll have connected it to a whole bunch of other things. You'll have had a massive integration. And similarly, if you learn something bad, you will find it extremely illuminating of all sorts of other things. Because being a principle, you'll be making vast integrations. Now, I'm going to give you an example, actually two at the same point, but first I'll give you the one that I got out of the newspaper. The New York Times is invaluable in my opinion, not only for the news, but also for sophisticated versions of every fallacy that you can expect. And this was right at the time that Orson Welles died, so that's what, 6, 7 years ago. So they gave an appreciation of him by Vincent Canby, who is their leading movie critic. And I simply have to read this because it leapt out of the page at me. I'm just giving you a couple paragraphs out of his whole thing, but you try to figure out what is the principle. He doesn't say it, of course, because if he did, he couldn't do what he's doing. Or else he would have to be a philosopher. And then he would write in such a way that they wouldn't hire him. Now, I'll read you just excerpts from this. It's a tribute to Orson Welles. Welles employed deep focus photography by which actors in the background are as clearly seen as those close to the camera. High contrast black and white film stock and long takes. And he has several other things like that. Now then he leads up to his big point. I'll read you a whole paragraph now. In The Magnificent Ambersons, Welles seemed to have found a way of combining the possibilities of cinema with the more formal demands of the theater to create something entirely new. Among other things, he allowed his movie audiences, like those in the so-called living theater, to choose what they would look at in almost any scene. Now then here comes the sentence of all sentences. He didn't coerce audiences with close-ups. In this fashion, he liberated the screen. Now, I'll read that again. Just the last part there. It was up to the audience to choose what they would look at. And therefore, quote, he didn't coerce audiences with close-ups. In this fashion, he liberated the screen. Now, do you have any reaction to that other than my reaction? I mean, you can just pick up my reaction, but to me, my hair stood on end with the statement that he liberated us. He didn't coerce us with close-ups. But what do you see in that? There is a principle, very definitely, a very evil principle that has thousands of applications and derivatives beyond the movies. Now, if you took this course before and you'd tell me the ultimate answer right at the beginning, I'll kill you. So I want an answer on the level of the arts or the movies, not an answer on the level of deep philosophy, first of all. I'm afraid of you because you're going to give the right answer. Yes?
Artists should not place their value judgments within their work.
Okay. You could put it as a first step that way, that if you place your values, your emphasis, your concerns into the work, that is coercive. You're forcing the reader, the viewer, to see things your way rather than to give him the freedom to do what he chooses. And therefore, if we have everybody without a close-up, he can look left, he can look right, he can look back, he can look at the character's knee, he can look up at his eye. He's free. Whereas if you give a big close-up of his face, he might have this passion to see the character's knees and he just can't do it. So you're coercing him. Now, you said very, very good. You shouldn't inject your values into your art. Now, you jumped right away to art as a whole. Normally, a person would say, would get to that by certain steps. He would say, well, the method of filming should not impose the director's perspective. And then they'd say, the director should keep his ideas to himself. And now what is the next step that they would encounter? Suppose they spoke to the playwright. What would they say to the playwright if they took Canby's line? Yeah.
Same thing, the playwright.
Yeah, you say, well, what business do you have giving Howard Roark, say, the novel, so many pages? And you give Katie, you know, the Toohey's niece, so few pages. Gus Webb doesn't get equal voice or equal hearing at all. And on top of that, by what right do you give Roark this startling hair and you make Gus Webb going bald? you know, etc. So that's not the way I want. Why should you coerce me with your vision of the characters and your interests and your concerns? Now, let's begin to try to project what would be then a totally uncoercive work of art, where you're completely free. Like, suppose I say, okay, I'm going to cut out my values. I'm going to write naturalism, just things as they are. For instance, like St. Louis. Well, who was a good writer? I enjoyed reading him, but he was a naturalist. He presented, as he thought, slice of life. And let's say he presented Arrowsmith, if you've ever read that, a novel about a nice doctor, more or less admirable, his various adventures. Now that's naturalism. Lewis would say, I'm not putting my values into this. I'm just showing this guy and his interactions with people, and this is just the way people speak, and so on. Now, could anybody accuse him of being coercive? Of being just as coercive as the close-up in the movies? Yeah.
Sure, he's saying focus on the scientist or focus on a meatpacking plant. He's not saying just look out at it.
Absolutely. He's picking the subjects you have to focus on, the amount of time you have to focus on them, who gets the attention, who gets the emphasis, what things about Arrowsmith he's going to tell us. He tells us a lot more about his medical education, for instance, than about his experiences with his grandmother, of which there's only one line. I suppose I want to hear more about the grandmother. As a matter of fact, she seemed to be a nicer character from the first sentence. But that didn't happen to be the book he was writing. Now, in other words, some form, whether you want it or not, of flaunting and, quote, coercing your audience is unavoidable in any work of art. It's impossible not to coerce if you are... Am I coercing you at this moment? Absolutely. I mean, this is as bad as a close-up. I have sentences from one philosophy which I'm stringing before you in a definite order with a tone of voice to hammer home one point. You're completely trapped. I mean, it's just as good as if I held a gun to your head and say that's it, because you have no choice. I mean, you can walk out of the room if you can bring yourself to do it, but you can't escape coercion. Now, what is the deeper problem, then, the deeper thing that can be objects to? Because if you said to him, well, what you really mean is the artist shouldn't inject his viewpoint, and you then said to him, well, but everything, every aspect of every work has to reflect his viewpoint. It's that aspect and not something else. So Canby would have to say, because he doesn't ask these questions or he wouldn't be a movie critic, but he would have to say, well, what I really object to is not close-ups or even something as narrow as a director's perspective or an artist's value judgments. The thing I really object to is when you give me something, what? Something specific. Anything specific, anything that's this thing rather than that thing, you are coercing me. You're forcing me to look at this thing rather than that thing. So what is the ultimate agent of coercion? The law of identity. Yeah. What he's really saying in that sentence, the principle is identity is contrary to freedom. Identity is a coercive force. Now, in other words, the fact that a work of art is something impedes my desire for it to be whatever I want it to be. The only solution is got to be non-objective art. Art where it can be anything you want it to be. You know, some modern mobile or smears, etc. But even that is not really any good. Because it's still this smear versus that one, and one of them is green, and one of them is muddy purple, etc., and so on. So it's still something, although they try to get around that by saying it's something physically, but spiritually, it's completely indeterminate, it can be whatever you want. But the idea here is specificity, concreteness, existing, is coercive. Now, you think, well, that's Vincent Canby. He's just a movie critic. I had already prepared all this and delivered it, and last week, this is June 21st, so this is hot off the press, front page of the New York Times Book Review. Under the headline, "The End of Books." You know, it's a standard. Every piece is called, you know, why literature has to end, why there's no more mathematics, why medicine should cease. And this is, and it's always in the specialist. This is the Book Review, so they're out to get books. Now, specifically, it's an attack on the novel as a dead, outdated form. Now, I'll read you sections from it, and I think you should grasp the idea. This is the exact same principle as Canby if you, as the close-up one, if you think in principle. Much of the novel's power is embedded in the line, L-I-N-E. And then he explains what he means by the line. That compulsory, author-directed movement from the beginning of a sentence to its period. From the top of the page to the bottom. From the first page to the last. Now he says, of course, I'm paraphrasing now. We've had brilliant authors who knew how to fight the line. You know, like James Joyce and a few others. But, quote, true freedom from the tyranny of the line is perceived as only really possible now at last with the advent of hypertext, written and read on the computer, where the line in fact does not exist unless one invents and implants it in the text. Now, a hypertext, he says, quote, describes the writing done in the non-linear, non-sequential space made possible by the computer. Hypertext provides multiple paths between text segments, now called lexias, with its web, like little fragments of words, with its web of linked lexias, its networks of alternate routes, see, depending on what you punch in which order, as opposed to print's fixed, unidirectional page turning. Hypertext presents a radically divergent technology, interactive and polyvocal. Polyvocal means it's saying many things at the same time, favoring a plurality of discourses over definitive utterance, and freeing the reader from domination by the author. Reader and writer become co-writers, as it were, fellow travelers in the mapping and remapping of textual components, not all of which are provided by what used to be called the author. Now he rhapsodizes about this, and this is, you see, no close-ups. It's whatever you want. There's no coercion. And his only problem with it is, he says, it's hard to, quote, it is still so radically new, it is hard to be certain just what it is. No fixed center, for starters, and no edges either, no ends or boundaries. The traditional narrative timeline vanishes into a geographical landscape, or exitless maze, with beginnings, middles, and ends being no longer part of the immediate display. Instead, branching options, menus, you know, he means computer menus, link markers and map networks. There are no hierarchies in these topless and bottomless networks. See, they know exactly what they're doing. There are nothing like paragraphs, chapters, and other conventional text divisions. These are replaced by evenly empowered and equally ephemeral blocks of text, soon to be supplemented with sound animation and film. Now, I just can't go on with that further, but this is a front page article meant straight and arguing in the field of literature exactly what Canby was suggesting in this little review. And you see now, therefore, that if you had grasped Canby seven or whatever years ago, in principle, You would be able to predict this article because it's exactly the same principle, namely that identity is coercive, and therefore they're trying to strip it away of any attribute. Now, most readers who would hear one of these things shake their heads and they say, there's something funny here, and they let it go. Or they may even think, well, he might have something, you know, to it, and that's it. That is not thinking in principle. Now, let us try to put down in a series of steps what the right method, what thinking in principle would consist of. And there are really three crucial steps. You have to widen your perspective on the issue. You have to look at other related concretes in whatever fields you know. And keep asking, is there something similar applicable, for instance, in the theater, in novels, in painting, etc.? Or is this something that applies only to the movies and only to directors? And then, I guess I could say four steps, because that would be the first. Widen your perspective to include as much of the rest of the universe as you could reasonably relate to this example. And then, second, state your first generalization. That'll be on the road to a principle, but something like, he doesn't like selectivity or values in art. Or he is saying values in art are wrong. Or selectivity is coercive, however you want to word it. Then, the third step is, go to the deepest principle you can, still within the context. And that will often involve you in philosophy, but more specifically than just A is A. And that's when you reach the point of saying, well, what he is saying would apply to anything. Anything anybody did. Is this and not that? So, the deepest principle he's advocating is identity is coercive. Now there, you got to the bottom of what he is saying in a way that explains it, ties it into all the rest of the things you know, all the other anti-identity attacks, and now, lastly, you can do one more thing. You can integrate that false principle to something else you know and connect it to the sum of your knowledge in all fields. And what else do you know about philosophy, modern philosophy, that would cry out to be integrated to the idea that identity is coercive? Who, what philosopher based his whole epistemology on that? Kant, that's the essence of Kant. That because our minds are something, therefore we're forced to think a certain way, we have no choice, therefore it's invalid. So it was Kant who said identity is coercive and therefore invalid in epistemology, and all these people are doing is applying it 150 years later to the cinema and to books. So you can tie it all the way back, or you can think if you want, if you don't know Kant, this is the same thing as praising God because he's infinite. So when you get to the stage where you can read Canby making a remark about Wells directing, and you say that's exactly the attitude of St. Jerome when he praised God for being everything in general and nothing in particular, then that is what you call an integration, see? Then you really see the assault on identity on all sides, and you were led to it through your own observation that something struck you in this small newspaper remark. Now, just about every newspaper is full of things of that kind. Now, I don't say you should, you know, do it day and night because it's a long process of thought. But if you would be amazed at the extent to which principles are there and are just crying out to be identified and integrated if you, you know, face the material of the news or of your human relations or whatever. And that's what was so great about perpetual conversations with Miss Rad. We never covered the same ground twice, even though we talked. It's impossible to count how many hours and nights and months and years. But she was always on the lookout for a new principle. And as soon as there was something that she felt was not completely the known, something that in some respect new, She was on the track of what else was like that that she could think of, and she would ransack her subconscious or her memories or go consciously through various fields until she could find something that she thought she could connect legitimately, not just arbitrarily. And it was always fascinating, because no matter what you started to talk about, she'd say, did you see the latest review in the Times? And I'll say, yeah, it was terrible. She'd say, but do you know why it was terrible? I'd say, well, he liked Wells. She'd say, oh, no, she says, this is it. She'd read, don't you see something in that? And, well, I guess that must be wrong, you know. And by the time it was over, she had me seeing, you know, that the Bible and the Critique of Pure Reason and all of that were in this review, and I was really stunned to think that I missed all of it, you know. So you can have that experience yourself if you try to apply this method within the context of your knowledge. All right, we're going to compromise and take a 7-minute break now.
Here we are.
Now I want to deal with some further questions on principles, and then we'll try to have a question period. I got so many examples here that I could go on for another 3 hours, but I think I'd rather hear your questions and just give you some last points to tie up what we've said so far. How do you prove or validate principles? And the answer is contained in what we've said so far, but it's worth making explicit. You reach them by induction. And you have to validate them by integrating to the nature of the entity involved. You reach them by continuous induction, and which itself is a form of integration, broader and broader, but then you solidify or nail down the principle by tying it into the nature of the entity involved. Let's take the example. Suppose you reach the principle that force is evil, or force has destructive consequences, simply by observing all the different examples of government and even private coercion and seeing the negative consequences. So you reach that broad principle. It would not be sufficient simply to say, well, every case of force that I've observed from all these different areas has been destructive. Therefore, I'm going to generalize all initiation of force as evil. You would have to have some idea, what is it about the nature of the entity, in this case man, that would explain this? What about man could you integrate with this so you could understand this in relation to the entity that you're generalizing about? You see that the initiation of force has bad consequences. Now, what do you know about man that would enable you to tie it in even in a general way?
Volition.
Man has volition. He has a conceptual consciousness. He has to exercise it by choice. And then you can see, obviously, well, if he's being coerced, he's not being given the opportunity to use his faculty of knowledge. So necessarily, he's going to have bad consequences. Even if that's all you saw, you couldn't write 25 or 50 pages, you would be in a better off situation epistemologically than if all you see is, well, I see that force never works, but I haven't got a clue. Because then it leaves open the question, well, maybe it's just bad people using force. Maybe if it was Democrats instead of Republicans, or, you know, coal miners instead of iron, etc., that would work. So what you try to do when you can, and within the level of your knowledge and context, is make your broad integration of generalizations, reach your principle, and then try to tie it into something that you know about the nature of the entity, even if it's fragmentary. So it's not just simply an observation without any connection to your knowledge of the entity. Now let's take one more example of a different kind. Now this is a philosophic principle. Knowledge requires a certain method on man's part. Now that in effect is the essential principle of epistemology. Now, how would you validate that? How would you reach it? And how would you validate it? How would you prove it? Well, in philosophy, as in everywhere else, You do not start with a definition and deduce. That's a rationalist approach. You don't say, well, knowledge is so-and-so, and so-and-so could only be reached by so-and-so, therefore. Because where would you get the definition of knowledge except by stealing it from somebody? So you have to start with reality, with observations. And in this case, what kind of observations about knowledge would you have to make to finally reach the culminating idea, knowledge requires a certain method? What was the first observation that anybody ever made about knowledge for which he was regarded as the father of philosophy? And he didn't even make it explicitly in the materials that survived, but he made it implicitly. You know, when Thales said everything is water, the big significance of that is not that he came out from water as opposed to air, but that he said we have to understand the world in terms of what we observe, not in terms of something mystical or supernatural. Knowledge begins with observation. And then subsequently, to jump all around here, Aristotle said, I observe something else. You cannot just put ideas together in any sequence. You must not contradict yourself. And in fact, if you want to show a conclusion, you have to put it together with certain earlier things and see what follows in order to avoid contradiction. And then let's say Ayn Rand comes and says, you can't form concepts in any arbitrary order. There's a certain hierarchy and they always have a context, etc. and so on. These are all individual observations. Now at a certain point, you can step back and say, there's an enormous broad principle involved here which ties in with Thales and Aristotle and Ayn Rand, etc., all discovered aspects of it. And the principle is, knowledge requires a definite method. You can't just do anything. It's structured, it's organized by the nature of our minds that we have to follow a certain method to get knowledge. And now, again, what can we tie that into about the nature of the knowing being, about the nature of man, that will make that explicable, and rather than just, I don't know, that's just the way it was. Well, you know that animals don't have to follow a certain method. So right away there's a contrast. Animals can just do whatever strikes them, and they can't go wrong. But a man has to follow a certain method. Why?
Yeah.
Because he has a volitional consciousness. It's not automatically correct. Therefore, he has to follow certain rules in order for his conclusions to be reliable. Now you see, all of these statements, which at a certain point you think are self-evident, knowledge requires a method and all that, have to be dredged up from the observations and discoveries of centuries. Then they have to be formulated in terms of broad principles and integrated into a whole philosophic system and view of man. And by the time you get it, you know, it's so easy for you to say, well, knowledge requires a certain method because A is A and everything has to be something, and Ayn Rand said it and it sounds good. But it's not then based on reality. To really validate a principle, philosophic or otherwise, you have to go back to the observational evidence, whether it's extrospective or introspective, successively generalize until you've got the broadest formulation that you can cope with in a certain context, and then see what can you do to connect this principle to the entities involved. And then you have understanding and clarity within that context, and further knowledge consists of just upgrading, you know, further the conditions or the deeper roots or whichever. Now I've been asked this question. This is just thrown in here because this question was asked, but I think you could now should be able to tell me the answer. Why has mankind found it easier to discover scientific principles than ethical principles? Is it in the nature of the subject? Because it's true. People have done great work in discovering principles in science. And of course, they're still on the level of 10 commandments in ethics, which are tremendously concrete bound. A lot of them have no other God before me and don't make images unless they sell for such and such. So on. Why do you think there is that difference between scientific principles and ethical principles? Now, some students said to me once, well, because you can make controlled experiments in science and you can in ethics. That's ridiculous. All of history is a controlled experiment, of which the old East versus West Germany is as controlled as you'll ever get. And nobody learned anything from that. So it has nothing to do with the method. In fact, I think that science is much more difficult than ethics. Much more complicated. Many more factors are involved, whereas the whole thing about ethics is it abstracts from all difficulties. It's only what's true of all people in all situations. It's so broad, you see, that it should be a lot easier. And yet, what is the reason that one has gone so far and the other has gone nowhere? Yes. Well, but he's volitional in both fields, science and ethics.
But atoms don't have choices in what they're going to do next.
Right. So why would that make it difficult to figure out principles? You say atoms don't have choices and men do. But how would that explain that people find it so difficult to formulate ethical principles? Yes, in the back.
Because of the mind-body dichotomy.
That's a very good answer. You say because of the mind-body dichotomy, that they're taught to approach the physical world one way and the spiritual world different. I was going to say, which is just a variant of that, because they have a split epistemology. That is, they have one rational epistemology, or they used to, in the field of the sciences, and they have only got religion and emotion and pre-civilized urgings in the other. So it's a perfect example of the principle that knowledge acquires a method, and they don't have that method. Now, then we can go one step in ethics. Now we can go one step deeper and say, why do they not have it? And why are they clinging so desperately to a method in ethics or philosophy that they would never dream of in physics or chemistry? And it's precisely because of those two fields, one is more important to everybody, including physicists. Which? Ethics. This involves yourself, your estimate of yourself, your estimate of people, your view of life. That's the thing that nobody can bear to have as an open question. And therefore, if philosophers have not provided anything, they will latch on to anybody who proposes to offer an answer, and that's exactly what religion has done through the centuries. It's been a primitive form of philosophy replacing philosophy and giving people answers, terrible answers. I see you, but I'm going to finish the sentence first. Answers with which they cannot live, but they can't live without them, and there's been nothing else offered to them. And that is why it becomes a self-fulfilling after a while. Decent people take one look at philosophy and they won't go near it. So the field remains a monopoly of, let us say, inferior specimens. And better people go into science, and it becomes like the Robert Stadler phenomenon. It's the self-esteem, or put it broadly, that the tie to man's emotional life is so crucial that they have to have something right away. And it takes an extraordinary kind of person, and I include you in the audience in this, to be brought up one way on those kind of questions and then say, I want to be rational and throw out whatever I have to. The overwhelming majority of people are unsalvageable after they're 16 or even 6. That's why it's so crucial to educate people well from the beginning, and that's why it's so hard to get a new philosophy started. Because you've got to educate the teachers to educate the students, but there's no teachers yet. Because it has to be those students who are going to become the teachers. So you have to penetrate very gradually, little by little, until you make your basic breakthroughs. Now, what did you want to say?
It's just that in science you can see the consequences more clearly.
Not true. Exactly untrue. You say in science you can see the consequences more clearly. On the contrary, I think in ethics you can see the consequences more clearly. Anybody can. Because ethics deals with only those consequences which are available to anybody at any time with any degree of knowledge. You can look back through history and see the consequence of statism nakedly. You can see the consequence of the difference between the 19th and the 20th century and know zero about what's going to happen when you put hydrogen and oxygen together. I mean, one is highly specialized. It's not that you can see it more clearly. On the contrary, you can see it clearly in one and not the other because you know what you're doing in one. And that's because you're using a completely different method. But if they came to science the way they come to religion, you'd have the equivalent of Lysenko. The state would, or whoever, would give you a theory, and that would simply be what you preach. Yes?
I would say it's exactly the opposite in difficulty, and that's why it's difficult. When a two-year-old starts to lie, his parents have to tell him you shouldn't lie for some reason.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't have to worry about does oxygen combine with hydrogen this way.
Well, that's why, you, in a way, you can't avoid the questions of philosophy. That's what I was trying to say. Oh, sorry. I wasn't supposed to touch the mic. you can't avoid the questions of philosophy, so you grope and grab onto anything. And a parent would feel worse saying to his 3 or 4-year-old, I don't know why. Everybody says you shouldn't lie, but I don't know why. Than if he said, well, you know, it's against God's word and you'll go to hell. Now, the best parents say, well, you wouldn't like somebody to do it to you, would you? And they count on that, you know, common sense. But then they're stuck later when, you know, the son gets some university training and he can counter, you know, the common sense. But at that point, they figure they've done their best. But it nevertheless remains true that and when you, if you think to millennia ahead, they're going to look back and be astounded at how stupid our civilization and our whole history was in terms of ethics and philosophy and how brilliant and technologically advanced and so on in the sciences. And they'll have whole courses trying to explain that. Now, I have a long example here about the role of context in forming principles, but I'm sure you understand that. Now I do want to raise one question because it's on the syllabus. Do men always function on principles willy-nilly, whether they want to or not? And the answer here lies in exactly the same question asked in regard to concepts. Do men have to conceptualize their experiences whether they want to or not? Now, Ayn Rand writes about the anti-conceptual mentality that hugs concretes and does not want to conceptualize. And we talk all the time about unprincipled people, not just in action but in thought. So, what is the answer? Do men have to live by principles? Well, obviously, they don't. If they did, there would be no point scrupulously trying to define and advise and say do it in these steps. So they would just come up with principles just as they come up with perceptual data. So obviously, you can be anti-conceptual, anti-principle. You don't live by those things. On the other hand, you can't escape it because you're a conceptual being. Even the anti-conceptual mentality talks, uses a whole bunch of concepts. And even he, whether he likes it or not, is guided by some kind of generalization because nothing else will prompt a conceptual being to act. So the answer is a resounding yes and no. And the thing is to distinguish the sense in which people can escape principles or conceptual formulations is obvious. They just banish it from consciousness. They don't know what they think or why they think it, and they don't even bother. They just react according to what? To the automatized material fed to them by their subconscious. But that is where principles come in, whether you like it or not. It's because of the subconscious that you cannot escape principles. Consciously, you can be a total pragmatist. You can be an absolute advocate of the expediency of the moment. You can say, I want to do what I want. But if in any one case you are selecting emotion over reason as your guide, what logically does that mean? You have accepted implicitly what principle? Emotion has primacy over reason. Emotion is my guide. Emotions determine when I will and will not go by reason. In other words, emotions are the decisive authority. In other words, if you don't accept the principle of reason, then you have to accept some form of the principle of emotion. And if you take that type of emotionalism, it will gradually become more and more dominant. It's exactly the same situation as, why can't you have just a few government controls? To hell with principles. Let's just have government look after the banking situation and some of the savings and loans, you know, and control insider trading, a few things like that, and otherwise we'll have a free market. Because you know that as soon as you accept one government control, you are saying there is something more important than freedom, something that supersedes it. And in any clash, and I believe there might be a clash, I'm going to take this thing, government control, over this thing, free market. Well, of course, you see that necessarily means capitulation to statism, and then it's just a matter of time. Now, the reason for this mechanism, the reason why you can't just do one emotionalist act or one statist act and then go back to square one again, is because a conceptual being cannot avoid some form of integration. The essence of a conceptual consciousness is integration. That's what we said thought is. And even an unthinking person cannot avoid some form of thought, that is integration. Because they need some kind of guidance to know what to do, and how to choose, what acts to take. So he can't escape principles in some form. The crucial difference is between rational, conscious principles and irrational, subconscious principles. If you are unprincipled in the conscious realm, then you will be principled in the bad sense subconsciously. The evil will become your principle. Now, why does it work this way, that if you default consciously, evil wins subconsciously? It isn't the case that if you do nothing, the good will pop up in your subconscious as your principle. If you do nothing, you just avoid thinking and stay concrete bound, the evil will come up. Why? Because here's my simplest answer to this. You cannot escape some integration, but you can easily escape the good. The good is a positive which demands work, consistency, effort, definition, all the things that go into a valid process of thought. It's a continuous effort of volitional monitoring and reasoning. That is not something that you can achieve automatically, mindlessly, or by accident. By those methods, that is just turning it over to the subconscious and saying, whatever comes up, comes up. I'm not controlling, defining, supervising, monitoring, just you take over. All you can achieve by that method is inconsistency, contradiction, confusion. In other words, in the end, the wrong, the bad, the evil, the anti-reality. So you can put it this way, evil is the negation of the good. When the conditions required for the good are not instituted, then evil has to take over by default. It has to become the implicit integration ruling men. So you can avoid principles in the conscious realm, but that then dooms you to destructive principles subconsciously. That's the only alternative left when you don't exercise the effort necessary to achieve ideas which are valid. If you want a further discussion of this, there's a lot of good formulations in my chapter on the virtues, specifically the section on integrity. There's a lot of good points in there with regard to why principles are inescapable. I found that virtue, to me, was one of the most helpful sections of the entire book to write, and represented one of the greatest breakthroughs in my understanding of objectivism when I finally understood why you had to function by principle. And the essence of the virtue of integrity was the principle of being principle. And so I got really bogged down for a long time, I think over a month, and then I finally started to get straight on what it was, and that is still to this day one of my favorite sections, because personally I was so confused, and so much of the whole philosophy was illuminated to me by that, and you can tell that because I have too many examples in that sequence. But, you know, I worked them all out, and they were all precious to me because they finally made it clear, so I'm giving it all no matter what. Whereas in every other example case, I cut out and just left one or two examples. So generally, as an insight, the more examples an author gives, the less clear he is about the point. Or at least the less clear he was. Now, finally, I want to answer one question as well as I can. What is the relation between thinking in essentials and thinking in principles? Well, let's just say some preliminary observations. To discover essentials, you are primarily engaged in a job of analysis, of taking apart a whole, like a concepts referent, or a book, or a person, or a philosophy, and you want to break it into parts, discard part as being insignificant, and then look at all the rest and try and reduce them to a fundamental. So you're primarily trying to reduce the data by breaking up into what counts and what doesn't. And you end up with one little bit which stands for the rest of the essential characteristics. A principle, on the other hand, relates more to synthesis or integration rather than analysis, to taking many observations subsumed in many generalizations and integrating them into a super formulation. Now, of course, you have to analyze to synthesize in every practice and vice versa. But just as an issue of emphasis, of division of labor, there's more concern with one in the one process and one in the other. There is, of course, a great many similarities. First and primarily, that both of these pertain to condensation, to unit economy, to condensing a wealth of information into fewer units. Essentials pertain to condensing a concept and then derivatively, individual wholes like a person, a movie, etc. A principle condenses generalizations. But as I say, the goal is the same, but in one, the focus is on reducing the data by discarding. And the other, you reduce the data by uniting. Now, having made certain preliminary distinction like that, I want to immediately say that the most important point is not the difference between them, but the fact that each is crucial to the other. I don't want to say it in a deliberately provocative way. I would say the principle is that each is essential to the other. And of the two, which is the more basic? Which has to come first? So if we use the archaic sense of principle, we would have to say thinking in essentials is the principle of thinking in principles. Is the origin, is the source. But there's no reason to say that except to baffle you gratuitously. The most basic is thinking in essentials, because that makes it possible for you to formulate and validate principles. And then those principles in turn enable you to analyze further data in terms of essentials. So actual real life development is a continuous spiral. You define something in terms of essentials, and combined with other knowledge, that leads you to a principle. And then that principle leads you to come to a new situation and grasp an essential that you wouldn't have grasped without the principle. But that principle in turn depended upon your grasping a certain essential and so on. So they're interwoven. It's absolutely not as though on Monday you form essentials and on Tuesday principles, or grade one this and grade five that. It's a continuous all the time. Now let me give you a simple example. The root, remember, is defining concepts and essentials. Without that, you can't get to principles or anything further. Let's take the term reason. And we define it in essentials as the man's faculty of cognition, you know, that functions through percepts and concepts, or however you want. But the idea is we're defining it in essentials as man's cognitive faculty. As against, imagine that we're thinking of it as, and this is a definition that's fairly widespread, the faculty of spotting humorous incongruities, which is one of the things that reason does, but it's not an essential. The reason we can spot humorous incongruities is because we can conceptualize and grasp contradictions, which animals can't. But there's a lot of people that say the faculty of reason is really the capacity that enables us to laugh because we see that things are funny. You never heard of that? Man is the animal with a sense of humor, so on. That's supposed to be the number one attribute desired by women in men, according to Playboy, I think I read there. In any event, if you use that non-essential definition of reason as the faculty to spot humorous incongruities, you will be lost in regard to further principles that involve the issue of reason. For example, you will never reach the principle that reason is man's means of survival. Because why should being able to have a belly laugh help you live one way or not? But if you know that reason is man's means of cognition, then of course that is a huge step forward when you grasp that he's a living entity and he has to act according to his knowledge, to grasping that reason is his means of survival, and that then is the principle. And now once you have that principle, you can come immediately to the essential meaning of that example we gave a couple lectures ago. Humility makes everybody safe. Remember how we said translate that into essentials? But you couldn't translate it into essentials if you didn't know that reason was man's means of cognition, which was a principle. Reason was man's means of survival, which was a principle that you could only reach by having come with the correct definition, that is the correct essentialized view of reason to begin with. Now, at this stage of knowledge, when you hear life, given your principle of life as depending on reason, you hear right away, well then, when he's talking about humility, he is saying, unreason is the key to survival. And that's obviously the negation of the right principle. So, essentials make the principle possible, and they then point you to an essentialized interpretation of new data, which of course will very often give rise to new principles, etc. Sometimes with the need of a lot more observations, sometimes not. So you see the interaction of them. They're two aspects of the same conceptual faculty. They're not the same, but they're very closely related, and properly speaking, you can't get along with one rather than the other. Now, I think I'll conclude this point by saying the one other thing that they all both have in common, which belongs to both of them, is that both are fundamentals. And that's, of course, is crucial to unit reduction. A fundamental is that on which other things depend. And economizing requires you to go to fundamentals. But people are sometimes confused between essential and fundamental. And I think, therefore, the best formulation to put it all together is this. An essential is a fundamental attribute. A principle is a fundamental generalization. Now, we had a class on this once, and we came up with all sorts of other, more confusing differences and similarities between essentials and principles. And I do feel that if and when this material was presented by someone in a systematic, hierarchical way, there would be a lot more than one could say about the integration of essentials and principles and why there are these two. But I'm giving you at this stage the kind of empirical observations that I can make about principles. I'm not yet thinking in principle about thinking in principle. I'm giving you the preliminary observations in this course that presumably someone will take over and organize according to principles and tie in with the nature of concept formation on much deeper levels than I have done here. So as long as you know that, I'm content to sort of end this lecture with a whimper rather than with a bang. And now I will take questions. I have some really great examples here of people who don't think in principle, but I think I'd rather hear your questions. Yes?
Dr. Peacock, could you speak a little bit about integrating thinking in principles and thinking in essentials to logic, which is reduction and simplification?
Well, logic, could I integrate essentials and principles with logic? Logic is the method of connecting subsequent content to earlier content, of building knowledge on earlier knowledge. So every process of logic, you know, that's just the science of inference, of reasoning, takes you back to induction and deduction. And neither of those are applicable or possible without the other. You can't generalize without a lot of deductions, and you can't deduce without generalization. So those two processes work hand in glove. And thinking in essentials is required for both. Until you think in essentials, you can't have clear concepts. And until you have concepts, you can't put them together into propositions and come to conclusions from them. Thinking in principle is essential to both too, because in induction you reach a generalization, which is the beginning of going to a principle, and in deduction you start with a generalization. So there are ways of singling out aspects of the reasoning process, preconditions of the reasoning process, that must be present in any full example of reasoning. They are methods of handling concepts so that you can then combine them into patterns and reason out new conclusions from earlier information.
That's what you have to bring to the logic.
That's right. I hesitate to say that's what you have to bring to logic, because if you say it that way, it's as like you come to logic armed with principles and essences, and the big question will be, where'd you get them? You had to reach them by reasoning, so it's a spiral thing. You have to start on the lowest level by some elementary observations and classifications, and then that leads you to some primitive generalizations, and that lets you organize a little more, and then you start, you see what I mean? You'd have to trace it. It would be tremendously complex, and there would be all kinds of options. All we're doing is saying that now, as adults, these are the features that you can look at to improve your thinking. But really, to be absolutely valuable, I should give a whole course on induction, you know, and theory formation, so you know exactly where you're going, and that would be the end of epistemology. Unfortunately, this is the beginning, not the end in the 20th century. Pardon?
2 years
to the next. Yeah, I doubt that. I doubt that I will be speaking on that topic. In fact, I flatly won't be. Ed, is that you?
I wanted to ask the connection between what you've been talking about, a comment Ms. Rand made when she was writing, I believe, never bother to examine a policy. Look what it accomplishes. Or a folly, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I was connecting that with the second quote from the New York Times in terms of what the writer is after, which appeared to be he was trying to foster non-intelligibility, which in turn meant he was against the concept of purpose, which means he was against integration, which means he was against reason, which means he was against man's consciousness, which means he was against his law.
Well, I mean, you could get to it that way, but that is a needless psychological excursion in terms of his motive. And, of course, if you're a psychologist, it's natural that you would pursue that path. But I'm concerned here only to teach what I would call philosophic analysis, how to go from the content of what he said to what it logically implies, not what it, what kind of a motive he had to have to say it, but what is he committed to implicitly, whether he acknowledges it or screams against it. Now, if you bring in, as Ms. Rand often did, motivation, there's another whole aspect clarifying why people say these corrupt things. What gimmick they're after, and that quote from Toohey is a good example, but that is not philosophy. You are then combining a theory of human motivation and of, you know, what would explain various actions. That comes within the field of psychology, and I try to stay away from that on the grounds that I don't have clearly enough a method to be able to make objective the broader principles. So I do it myself. I say, he wants so-and-so, but I don't lecture on that. I restrict myself to philosophic analysis in classes. Now, I just want to say one more thing about don't bother to examine a folly. Ask yourself what it accomplishes. Who was there speaking, Ayn Rand or Ellsworth Tewitt? Now, some of the things he says, she agrees with. But that one, she only agrees with 50%. That one, she agrees with from the point of view of this. There's all kinds of garbage that we're taught. It all leads to the same destructive conclusion. On the other hand, and since Toohey was the one perpetrating this conclusion, it's logical to give him that line, which she was sympathetic to. But if you just took that out of context and said to her, do you believe in this? As a principle of approach, don't bother to examine a folly, ask yourself what it accomplishes. I can hear the words in her mind. She'd say, how do you know it's a folly if you don't examine it? How do you know what it accomplishes if you don't know what it means? You see, if she didn't say about the Critique of Pure Reason, I don't bother examining that. I know it subverts man. She wrote vast amounts on what was the exact nature of his fallacy, how was he led to it, what premises. She did the exact opposite of Toohey's analysis. So that statement came in a context, and If you have to choose, my opinion would be, I would much prefer a philosophic than a psychological explanation, even if the latter is available. I can't prove that, because there is no false dichotomy of that kind, but at least I know what I'm doing when I give a philosophic analysis, so let's leave it at that. Okay, do we have other questions on principles? Yes. Wait, I'm going to give you a chance, Becky. Yeah. The part I left out, you mean? Well, it's pretty long. Well, you really want that? Well, this will be the last question, and I'll try to do it in a condensed form. Actually, the way I was going to approach it was to make it interesting by making it complicated. Oh, you don't know what I'm talking about. I left out a section on why principles are contextual because I thought it would take too much time and I'd rather hear your questions, and they just asked me to give that section. So now I'm trapped in trying to condense into 5 minutes what I gave up trying to do in 10. But I'll give it to you in the way I have it, and if it's too condensed, just write it off as the lecture ended early. This was a Platonic question I was asked once that I always thought was fascinating because it's straight out of Plato and the person never heard of Plato. You know, Plato's idea is you have to have innate knowledge to know anything. Plato said in several of his dialogues, you could never define honesty. You'd never know what was essential to it if you didn't have in your mind a guide from another life telling you this what counts as honesty and this isn't, and therefore we must have innate ideas. And this student who did not know Plato wrote exactly this. Do you need to already grasp the principle of honesty in order to focus your attention on the fact that dishonesty is accompanied by harm? After all, there are other consequences one could focus on if one does not have the principle itself in firm grasp. One could focus, for example, on the praise that a deceitful worker receives from his unknowing co-workers or boss. Now, obviously, that is not a rational way of looking at the issue. But isn't there something else, some other principle or standard at work subconsciously that leads you to know what the essential facts are to focus on and to ignore the non-essentials? And in other words, don't we somehow have to know what honesty is and what's relevant to it in order to figure out what, you know, is essentially what's wrong with it? Do you follow that question? Now, that is a purely Platonic question. And there, my answer, I guess I shouldn't really have approached this complex a topic via a backdoor Platonic question, but that's how it was raised to me, is that principles are always formulated in a context. And the same is true of essentials. You do not start from scratch every time. Otherwise, you would be a newborn baby, tabula rasa, every time. Now that question, just like all of Plato's arguments for innate ideas, projects by implication. You come to the field of honesty and you haven't got a clue about anything. Now you've got to get honesty from scratch as a baby would. Well, how does a baby know whether praise from the boss is or isn't essential? So he just heaps on the table, you get praise and you get a salary and you feel bad and he doesn't know, you know, which is essential and which is inessential. And he would only find out from Ayn Rand, and therefore you have to know honesty to find honesty. See what I mean? Now, the answer to all of those constructs are you do not start from scratch. You always have a context, and you learn from the successive context. For instance, let's say you're primitive, but you're still not a newborn baby. You've got enough vocabulary to grasp lying versus truth and boss versus employee and etc., etc., so you're fairly far advanced. But you've never thought, let us say, about the issue of lying. So you see a man lie, he gets this unearned job for which he's unqualified. Now, you don't know about honesty, so you just observe. Well, then you just try to find out what happens. You see his boss praises him, and he's very happy about that. And he gets a salary check, and he's very happy about that. And he always makes mistakes. See, since he's not qualified, only you haven't tied that in yet. And he has accidents frequently. He falls and bumps his head into the wall. You don't know why. It just seems that's the type of person. And he gets invited to a party by his relatives. And he's anxious most of the time. And his salary is reduced. And he makes more and more messes at his job than he's fired. Now, you see that whole spectacle. Now, if you don't know anything, you can't make anything of it. You're like Rourke with the principal behind the dean. Something is going on here. But you have to try to observe and grasp what events are essential to that situation and what are accidents. What is something that was long-range and unavoidable across time, and what was a momentary aberration? And it doesn't take too much intelligence to see that bumping your head into the wall has no apparent connection to whether you tell the truth or not. That being invited to a party by your relatives, who presumably don't know the situation, is irrelevant. It's easy, pretty easy to say that the boss's praise is going to be temporary, because this guy doesn't know what he's doing. That was the essence of his deceit. He was telling that he knew all this when he doesn't. He's qualified when he isn't. So it seems on the face of it that praise can't last very long by the nature of the setup. And he'd have to botch up the job ultimately and be fired. Now, if this is that first time, you just get to that much. Your experience has told you certain things like praise doesn't prove too much because it might be praised based on the wrong thing. Other things like popularity among your relatives are just irrelevant. Obviously, what's relevant has to be the quality of the work that you put in across time. That's all you know so far. Then you go on to other concretes. And as soon as you start observing them, right away your preliminary knowledge of essentials goes to work. You're starting to look now from the point of view of what is accident, what is causally connected, what is just a matter of human choice, like what we call the man-made, like the boss's praise, etc., and what is inherent in the situation. And the next time you see somebody get praised, you don't say, well, at least I know for sure one good thing comes from lying. Because you know that praise is highly variable. It depends on who's doing it and why. And the same thing if you get $1 million. You don't say, well, at least I know one good thing that comes from bank robbery. You get $1 million because you know already that you can get things that explode in your face even if you don't know exactly why and how. This is the process in which, as you go along, you continuously categorize. You find out from experience what is essential and what isn't. You find out what is tied to this event and what isn't. What is part of reality and what isn't. What is variable and what is long range. In primitive terms in your early context, and then you see it over and over, the way Rourke did see second-handedness over and over. And finally, you get to a level of induction and integration where you can say, I can explain all of these observations. In all cases, they're trying to fake reality to gain a value. And that is impossible because you're trying to get something from reality by declaring war. That is, if you're a philosopher, you reach the final integration. You tie it to reality and causality and so on. But you get there in gradual, painful steps, and you may never get farther than telling the truth to your boss, you know, before you run over or die or get bored. But the fact is, if you don't project as a situation inducing in a vacuum, if you start as a child would, with the things he would notice and the type of conclusions he could come to, and then use that as your background for the next observation and the next, you will see that you can actually generate all knowledge from observations, and you do not have to be guided by having the knowledge in advance. What guides you is not innate knowledge, but the context that you continuously expand. And that context is what steers you in the direction of the next step. Now, I inadvertently, unavoidably gave you 1 minute too long today, so we'll close now. Thank you very much.